record. Okay, so the first thing I have to do is just recite the statement to you. So it says, the key objective of this interview is to serve as a research tool to document memories of the American chestnut in the southern Appalachian region. Information obtained in these interviews will be retained and made available for further use in an effort to promote a better understanding of the role of the American chestnut in Appalachian culture. So then I have to ask, have you signed the participant identification and release agreements?
Yes.
Okay, great. So now we're ready to start. We're legal. So the first thing I just want people to say is, will you just tell me your name, when you were born, and where you're from?
Okay. I'm Edwin Manchester. Was born 1933 at Bent Creek, North Carolina. Was born at what is now the Appalachian Forest Experiment Station. I'll recount some of the stories my father told, because he had he was accused of the blight following him from New England, because he moved from New Hampshire to where he was district ranger in the, what is it, Green Mountains there, I guess, to middle Virginia, to Irwin, Tennessee, to Hot Springs, North Carolina, to Bent Creek. And I think a lot of the chestnut followed, or a lot of the blight followed about the same route. So the fact of the matter was, he laid out a lot of the Appalachian Trail, and he had the measuring wheel. And I guess the only one the Forest Service had then. So he brought the wheel with him as he came to lay out more trail. But you want me to just move on into...
What's a measuring wheel?
It's like a bicycle wheel that every time it goes around, it clicks and records another 4 feet or 5 feet, whatever it takes to.
Wow.
And so he carried a little router, portable router, in his pack, and stopped and made signs at the gaps or the trail crossings and stuff on the AT, and then recorded distances. But that was just a small part of the job, but a lot of his cronies attributed to his moves to they didn't have the wheel there yet. But he thought that the spread he could see was tied to tannin mills or acid plants where they tan leather, because they bought the chestnut bark, and that the blight spread seemed to radiate from those tanning plants. Have you ever heard that?
That's interesting.
That was here. It would have spread anyhow, but he was saying the center of the spread seemed to radiate from those acid plants, or acid wood, they called it.
Yeah, wow. And I've heard of them using the bark for tanning and all
right.
that, but I hadn't heard that theory about blight. Was your dad from New Hampshire, or how did he...
Yeah, he was from New England, and went to ranger school in New York, and his first job with the Forest Service was in New Hampshire. And but my first recollection of chestnut was the big old dead stems that dominated the landscape around Grandfather Mountain, all of that range of mountains through there. Huckleberry picked and fished the time I was a youngster, and saw those big hulks of chestnut, some of them I guess 5 feet through or bigger. And I remember one fire pretty close to Grandfather Mountain that after the head fire went through, the chestnut trees were on fire then, the dead ones. That they stood out in the daytime because they were bleached out almost white, kind of a bright gray color. And you just see them all over the mountainside standing out. But on the fire, all those big, a lot of them had some hollows in them, and they were like great big torches and be like fireworks going off, because there would be maybe 100, 150 of them on fire at the same time. And that's one of my first memories of seeing all those. That would have been in the early 40s, I guess, or mid 40s maybe. But I came here to Murphy, North Carolina in 63, and I knew Ivan Thor. Dr. Thor was the forest geneticist working at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville. And he had a lot of interest in chestnut, and began trying to pick trees with some resistance and propagate them. And he kept thinking he had one, and he'd let out a little publicity and everybody'd get excited and then they'd blight. But he kept trying and kept trying to radiate them, radiate the seed, to try to change the chromosomes. So I collected a lot of the seed that he did that with. Came from here. And I know one of my favorite trees stayed there for 30 or 35 years. And the power company finally thought it was too close to the power line and cut it down. That made me gnash my teeth and other things. But I'm trying to come up with the fellow with the Tennessee Division of Forestry at Knoxville that works with tree improvement, Russ Cox. Russ Cox worked with Thor, and I remember he had real good success with making use of the chestnuts. He was propagating with seed, and he'd cut them in half, or pull them apart into a half, and got to 1 year and got to successful plants from both halves. And the next year he made them in four pieces, got success. And I think he kept on till he got to almost 16ths, or at least in eighths, so he'd get eight plants from one seed. He did a lot of work in the, oh gosh, I can't remember where, his late 60s or early 70s. And I think Russ is still works for Tennessee.
So this would have been after the U.S. government gave up their chestnut restoration program.
I think so, yeah.
Did your dad ever tell you anything, or do you know anything about that program? Or
he did some. I know I talked once with, I think, Dr. James. Okay. I believe in New Hampshire. He was with USDA Forest Experiment, Northeastern Forest Experiment Station. And he did a lot of work in chestnut, and has a lot of, from his seed, there's a lot of plantations scattered around. Some at Bent Creek, the experiment station out of Asheville. And we took some of his better crosses and grafted them, and found out we couldn't do that successfully because we were planting them here, and they'd grow like dickens for three, four, 5 years and then blight out. And we grafted maybe, I don't know, 18, 20 different families and with 0%. We did learn how to graft them. We do a top cleft graft, and trying to thank the little, the biologist with TVA that told me how to do it. He said to go out in the morning and touch the top of that. Don't immediately graft when you make your cut of the understock, but go out till there was no sap. Keep touching that till it was dry. He said if you didn't do that, it would sour out. And it turned out he was right. We got about 30% on our first attempts, and then we did it his way and got like 80% success. And plantation's still there of all those crosses, but I'm reasonably sure there's 0 hybrids in the bunch. I think everything is just the understock that's come back. But I've heard a lot of the old timers talk about here a big thing was ranging turkeys and hogs in the mountains, turning them out to eat chestnuts in the fall, and rounding them back up. And
yeah, that's definitely the biggest memory that people have. That and like they remember getting pricked by burrs. That's like the things that really stand out in people's memories.
And
do you remember any specific stories? Any of those folks?
Well, I'll try to recount the one Esther has. Okay. My wife's mother, my mother-in-law, saved up. She wanted a pump organ. And she picked up chestnuts to buy the pump organ. Sold them. What would you guess, Esther, how much a bushel? Maybe a quarter. So she had to make $17 for the pump organ. Probably maybe a used one, or was it new?
Wow. Did
And they were trade things. They'd take them to the store and trade them for groceries.
Was that did your mother-in-law live around here in Murphy? Or?
Lived in Ashe County. North Carolina.
Okay.
And it's the same all over the mountains. People traded them. They'd around Grandfather Mountain country, they would go by train to the, I think they sold a lot of chestnuts lower South Carolina and Georgia. The train would go from, it didn't go to Blowing Rock, but I guess they'd take them by wagon to Lenore and put them on the train to go to Low Country and sell them.
Yeah, I feel like I've heard some people I talked to in Madisonville talked about that, and I haven't really gotten any great or any older people in Georgia. But it seems like people down around this area of Tennessee talk about trading them. But mm-hmm. people I talked to up in eastern Kentucky and like southwest Virginia just didn't remember that as well. But I think it's probably because where the train went didn't go, probably go through eastern Kentucky,
mm-hmm.
that area, but it would have come through around here.
And they would around here and over there too, there'd be some people that would take wagon loads of stuff to wherever their market was. They'd take a wagon load and drive turkeys too, and that was a challenge. Is instead of hauling the turkeys, they'd drive them in flocks, and turkeys don't drive well. And so I've heard some of those stories. They'd camp at night and sleep under the wagon. And I don't remember what all they did take. They'd take apples and chestnuts and can't think what else they sold that would be in the fall. Maybe a late crop of cabbage or what else, Esther?
Ham.
Take cured hams, sure.
Side meat.
Yeah, and side meat.
So you're saying they'd take them to the train, put them on the trains?
No, they'd take those from here. I guess took them to Atlanta area. They'd take them south from here, and at Lenore, they may have taken them to Charlotte or Columbia, South Carolina.
I talked to Rex Mann. He said something similar to that, and he said it was probably because down there there are so many plantations. They were like putting all their land into growing cotton or whatever it was, and then so they depended on these people coming down from the mountains to.
When did you see Rex?
It was maybe a month ago.
Okay.
6 weeks ago, maybe.
We'll visit a little later about him.
Yeah.
He's a long time friend.
Yeah, he was great. He was really great to talk to. So did you ever see chestnuts? I guess you did see. Like, did you ever pick up chestnuts yourself?
Well, I've collected them for Thor, and Esther has too. She can climb a tree better than I can, so she's. It's a real trick now to get chestnuts because you got to get them before the chipmunks or the squirrels do. And about the only way to do it is to climb a tree or get them where you can get them off a tree. We had good success 3 or 4 years ago because we hit it just right, and we got. I think we collected off of 7 trees.
Did you ever hear any stories about the way people would prepare them or eat them? Anything interesting there?
Not so much. Heard about roasting them and boiling them and using different dishes, but most of what I remember is for the Asiatic or Italian chestnuts. I know the Cherokee really prize them for bread. Chestnut bread, the Cherokee like a whole lot better than wheat bread. And they make cakes out of them. I had a cake once that Paola Craddock made. She can make chestnut cake.
Yeah, she's great.
Did I pronounce her name right?
Paola.
Okay.
Yeah. Just like when you were a kid, do you remember seeing? I guess they were already.
Didn't all I remember is those big shells of trees. I've gotten logs and seen loggers. The logs that are good, probably there's still some around, are the ones that fell over, got wind thrown or something into a hollow or a wet place or high rainfall place, and they got covered over with moss. And there's just a few years ago were still good, I presume. They still are. We'll show you. Our cabinets and panel are made out of chestnut. That's where they came from, was logs that hit the ground and mossed over. They stay good.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of people say that too. One guy down in Georgia was saying that was whenever he is out in the woods, that's the kind of wood he looks for, because even though it's been dead for so long, it's one of the, still it hasn't rotted away.
The ones that are so far as I know, that are good are the ones with a lot of log moss on them. That helps, I guess, keep the air out and keep them preserved.
Yeah. So do you think your dad had a particular interest in chestnut trees over other
I think he did. Well, he probably salvaged, had timber sales that salvaged a lot of them that were dead as he came from New Hampshire to Virginia to Irwin, Tennessee. And they were wonderful for just about anything, the furniture. I've heard the old furniture people. I worked for Broyhill Furniture at Lenoir for a while, and some of the old hands said that the chestnut was just wonderful to work with because it sanded good, it held nails good, it wasn't too awful heavy, you didn't have to sharpen your equipment as often because it planed good. They were really spoiled working with chestnut. It does fuzz up kind of as you plane it, and I guess sand it too a little bit. Not so much fuzz up, but make a lot of dust that some people are allergic to. I've heard people that got pretty sick planing chestnut lumber. I don't know why, but I remember this we did for the house. I helped do it. Another fellow and I planed it, and he got sick and I didn't. And I think we both had respirators on, and I don't know. Maybe his wasn't as tight as mine or something. Let's see, what else do I recall? The folks in the Northeast have got a lot of records and a lot of expertise on research. They're good with the, what is it, electrophoresis that tracks the families.
Mm-hmm.
And they've gotten where they're really good at that. Connecticut Experiment Station is particularly good with it. And Notre Dame. I think Notre Dame is as well.
Did you ever hear your dad or anybody else talk about how the forest just looked different when the chestnuts were there?
They said it was just overwhelming how big and how thick they stood together sometimes. And I have an old photo, I just now thought of it, that came from Robbinsville over in Graham County, North Carolina, of four or five of them standing 10, 20 feet apart, and they were all like 4 or 5 foot chestnuts. So I'll dig that out before you leave. But I don't remember that there was a lot of lumber companies that kind of followed the chestnut south. I don't know where they were conscientiously following blight. I think it just happened that they cut out a lot of the big timber in the Northeast and the northern central states, and then came to the Appalachians, and then they went to Idaho, Oregon, and Washington from here.
Dude, so did you ever work? I know you said you worked with UTK and all that. Is that what you did for a living, or?
I was a seed orchard manager with U.S. Forest Service, and we grew seed for the Southern Appalachian Forest, improved tree seed. Worked with three different pines and black cherry, four different oaks, and yellow poplar. Now they don't call them seed orchards, they call them genetic genetic resource areas or something like that. But the one is still here for the Southern Appalachians.
Oh, cool. I don't know much about that.
They have a few chestnut, not many. They have, I've worked, my work with Thor was while I was with USDA, and then have worked with Dr. Sklarbaum when he came there, and then in 1990 I started working with him after I retired in 90. Well, I've worked with Sklarbaum ever since, periodically. Mm-hmm. Worked with any trees with diseases that we were looking for a genetic tie. And he'd worked probably more with butternut than anything else.
Mm-hmm. I've been talking to people about that too. Like, I guess you probably do think it's important to restore the, or why do you think it's important to restore the chestnut tree?
Well, chestnut just had so many uses. It was just one of the best wildlife foods, I guess, we've about ever had. And then was just a super wood for cabinetry or furniture or any, just about any wood use, I guess. And plus the American chestnut nuts were good for a lot of cooking uses too. And I personally, with no scientific backing, I think they'll come back. The Italian chestnuts grow in a similar environment, and they blighted out and came back. And so I don't see any reason. I don't think I'll see any of them, and you may not, but somebody will, I think.
Yeah.
I think they will evolve to, one of these days there's going to be one resistant, and then it'll go from there, but it's not there yet.
Yeah. Why do you think the chestnut, or why do you think so many people get involved with the Chestnut Foundation and want to save the tree? And
it's just a wonderful feeling, I think, to be involved with something where you have the potential of restoring a popular tree, a tree with all those attributes.
Like, one thing that I think is really interesting is that a lot of people that I've talked to who are part of the Chestnut Foundation or interested in the restoration process, a lot of people who are involved and are motivated and interested had parents who told them about chestnut trees,
mm-hmm.
or they sort of like had these stories told to them.
Sure.
Do you think, or can you speak to that at all, or do you think that sort of that sentiment or nostalgia or plays into it at all? Or?
Sure it does, yeah. Everybody I think about that lives in the Appalachians or maybe the East, if they're long-time residents, have heard those old stories about the ground being covered in them, and the hogs fattening up, and the turkeys, and I guess cattle ate them. And, it's just an attractive bit of nostalgia, I guess, isn't it?
I think it's really interesting to think about that as a motivating factor for
mm-hmm.
people to get involved. And have you seen, do you think that the American chestnut is particularly just because it was so useful and so just like widely used, I guess. Do you think that makes it an easier tree to want to restore?
I think so. I think that's right on, pretty much on target. But, I mean, when either technology or our genetics makes resistant stock available, everybody will jump on the bandwagon to reforest it.
Mm-hmm.
We can now reforest oak, and that was, we thought, difficult to do 30, 40 years ago. I think chestnut will be easier than oak.
Do you think that there's more people interested in restoring the chestnut than the other, like the butternut and the other trees that you've
talked about? Sure. Butternut used to be sort of a popular thing, but I've found in my visits up and down the Appalachians looking for it that a lot of the foresters now doesn't jump out at them. They don't know one. They think it's a black walnut when they see it. But a lot of them do know it, but I've run into quite a few that didn't. And I'm sure the general public, that's not on their radar much.
Yeah. Do you know of any other like nonprofit organizations that have been started around the restoration of a tree? Is it
on the chestnut?
There's the American Chestnut Foundation for people wanting to restore the chestnut. Mm-hmm. But are there any other organizations that formed around trying to restore other kinds of trees?
Can't think of it. Maybe. Yeah. Well, yes. There's some now that are trying to restore the hemlock.
Oh, yeah.
From the adelgid.
Yeah.
What about the dogwood?
Dogwood, I don't know. There may be. That's one that was, genetics played a big role in. We crossed some Western, or I don't know all the genetic background, but they came up with a tree that looked like a Cornus florida that is crossed with something else and resistant to the dogwood and anthracnose. And we have great hopes that we think that there's resistant butternut to the butternut disease. And so we have great hopes that genetics will work on that. But.
Mm-hmm. Earlier you were saying how you might not see the chestnut in your lifetime. I might not see it in my lifetime. So I think that's interesting too, that we're like talking about maybe 100 years down the road, and there's going to have to be a certain amount of work done in kind of more rural places for people to try and get these trees back in the wild.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been asking people about do you think it'll be difficult to get people who are going to be landowners and grown up people in the next 20, 30, 50 years to get involved in the effort? And if yes or no? And
I think the only problem will be having the stock to plant. I think everybody's going to want them.
Why do you think
the same time?
Are want them?
Because of all these stories they've heard. And they're right. It's just a great tree.
Mm.
And when there's either a hybrid or a natural resistance tree, well, everybody's going to jump on the bandwagon and want all they can get or for their acreage.
Mm. And so you think these stories will play a part in that?
I do. Yeah. Sure.
Do you think that it'll be, that people will, do you think that, like, your father told, or do you think that people will tell their children about Chestnut in the same way that your father told you about Chestnut? Or how will that change?
Well, it'll probably be less and less total number of people that are interested in it, because some of that's going to get diluted, some of the stories will, with young people not being interested in it. But still, I think like the following of the Chestnut Foundation now, there's going to be a lot of people that maybe haven't heard a whole lot of stories, but they're just, that's just a neat thing to be involved with, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let's see, do you remember, I've been asking people, do you know any, like, traditions or sayings, songs, kind of stuff like that about chestnuts? Have you heard anything like that? Like kind of folklore stories that incorporate?
I don't. The one person that would know would be the folklorist at John C. Campbell Folk School, David Brose, BROSE.
Okay.
I don't know his email. I know his phone number.
Okay, I'm going to get that from you, because I would love to. I've been wanting to find, you know how there's like all those kind of old-time sayings people have?
Mm-hmm.
I feel like there must be some about chestnuts.
There very likely is, but I can't. Well, I do. Now, I do think of something sort of related. One of the Forest Service recreation technicians was visiting a campsite over on Chateaug Lake, and one real old lady was sitting there whittling with a knife, and they had a campfire going, and they talked a little about firewood, and she said, "I sure hope that when I die they've got plenty of chestnut wood." And he said, "Why?" She said, "When I hit the fire, I want to be popping and cracking."
That's great. That's really great.
Because when you burn chestnut, it pops and cracks.
Yeah.
Makes a lot of noise.
That's great. Yeah, I've heard people say it was good for putting in the stove, but it wasn't good for putting in the fireplace because
mm-hmm.
it would pop and crack out.
Right.
That's great.
Because it'll throw coals.
Yeah, that's what I've been, like, so a lot of people tell me that they remember hearing about feeding hogs to or chestnuts to the hogs,
mm-hmm.
and building split rail fences. And,
sure.
You know, building their barns out of chestnuts, stuff like that. But it's those, like personal kind of
mm-hmm.
stories about specific people or that are unique to the individual that are really fun and really great to hear. You worked with the Forest Service or
32 years.
Okay. In that time, do you feel like would people ask about Chestnut a lot? Or?
Sure. That there was just the people in the receptionist at the Ranger District office had somebody in real regular saying they found an American chestnut tree, and probably 80% of the time it would be a European or Asiatic chestnut that had gotten out, but some of them were. I went to a great big one time in Clay County, North Carolina. That must have been 36, maybe 40 inch. And it was still alive, but not much. Mm-hmm. And it threw a lot of the ground just covered with empty burrs where it had crops of nuts on it. But it was dead from the blight and didn't know it yet. It's still making nuts. Anything that is under a lot of stress like that. Throws a lot of fruit.
Yeah. How do you think that the chestnut blight changed people's lives? Like just the way people live? Do you think it had much of a...
Sure. It had a great effect. It closed all the tannin mills, I guess. I don't know if they could use where they use some oak for tannin or not. And there might have been other factors that played a big role in closing the... for one thing, about that time we started using less leather. I don't know which came first, our use of leather or the chestnut blight, but at one time, well, when I grew up, teenagers would love to have a new leather jacket every year or two. And you don't see that now, or just a whole lot of uses of leather even then. But it changed a lot of the thinking in the furniture industry, and gosh, I don't know what else, but it surely made a big economic impact.
Did you ever hear about any more kind of obscure or really localized efforts to stop the blight? Any sort of remedies people kind of made up?
No, I haven't. I've heard of people burning the woods to get rid of insects, but and some may have done it to get rid of the blight, but I haven't heard that specifically. And I've heard of people in, but I guess that was researchers mostly trying different things like inoculating the trees with a antibiotic.
Mm-hmm. I just didn't know if there's any sort of like things that some old mountain man would have tried to do, or if people just sort of accepted it.
They probably did, but I haven't. Mm-hmm. I haven't heard the stories. I would guess they did, because there's a lot of resourcefulness in the Appalachians, and they had all sorts of uses of water. I knew one fellow that under Grandfather Mountain, Bill Crump, that had never been to school, but he made furniture, and he didn't have electricity to where he lived, didn't have any power lines, but he rigged up a generator, water-powered generator, and had a little furniture shop with electric equipment. And it was just worked like a charm. But and then a lot of the old folks' house had water to at least come outside the house from a source, maybe a lot lower than the house, by using a ram, where a little trickle of water would go in a hydraulic ram, that would build up pressure and squirt water up to a higher elevation.
Wow. That does amaze me too, the ingenuity of people.
Yeah.
What about, were there any like games or holiday celebrations or kind of gatherings that happened around Chestnut?
A lot of the Cherokee celebrations happened around corn. And there may have been some around Chestnut, but the lady that we're referring to over at Cherokee will know that, I bet. I don't. It's about time for the annual corn festival at Cherokee, and that's not open to the public, I don't think. I think it's for native people.
Do you think the chestnut's an important cultural symbol for Appalachia?
I expect they are, but I don't know examples of it. No. There's a lot of folklore about Buckeye, which is a lot of people confuse that with chestnut because it's in Appalachia, it's called horse chestnut. In fact, there's a restaurant close here called Chestnuts. And a lot of the inside of the restaurants is chestnut paneling. And there, I've noticed their menus have chestnut leaves on the front drawn on. And it's not American, it's horse chestnut. Buckeye. I think Dr. Craddock called that to their attention maybe one time. Don't remember if it's him or somebody else. No, we better not say it was Craddock. Makes sense, but we better not say it.
I know he is a really good character. He's fun to work with. What about, so do you remember, what time would the blight have passed through the area where you grew up?
Well, my recollections are in the early 40s, probably. And then there was just the big old dead skeletons of trees. And I don't remember my dad went to Virginia in about 1923, and they were dead there then, and came to Irwin in maybe 25 or 6 or something, and they were dead there then. I don't know how far. I've never read the history of it.
So they were already all gone by the time you were old enough to remember?
I don't know where they were. There were pockets of them or not. I don't remember seeing them. All my recollection of living trees are sprouts. And I had owned a piece of land near Blowing Rock, and it had big sprouts that some of them were probably 8-9 inch diameter and 45 feet tall. And that was in the late 50s, 60s. But I just sort of have the feel that the sprouts got smaller and smaller before they got to blight. And then maybe in the 90s or around the turn of the century, they started getting a little bigger. But I don't know whether that's just my reaction of seeing more or bigger ones, but I don't know whether that's fact or not. But it kind of seems like they're getting bigger.
That's interesting.
And if they are, that gives us some encouragement of resistance, I guess. Or
yeah, definitely. What about, were there any places called, like, named after Chestnut, like Chestnut Ridge?
Sure.
Yeah,
there are. There's Chestnut Knobs all through the Appalachians. Seems like there's a Chestnut Mountain somewhere. I forget where. Chestnut Flats. Chestnut Ridge. Sure, a lot of... Don't know any streams, but... Yeah, it's, I think, the name's all over the Appalachians. Just like Buffalo is. It's curious that I don't know how long the buffalo have been gone, but there's a lot of names persist of buffalo because we had, you know, the eastern buffalo.
That's interesting. Huh. Let's see. So what about as far as the restoration effort goes, how have you been involved in the Chestnut restoration?
I think most all I've done is grafting that signwood Dr. James sent, and collecting nuts for, I think almost all of my collections have been for UT Knoxville.
So what motivated you to get involved and to do that?
Oh, any tree or plant or anything that has danger of being extinct is plenty of motivation. I've had a special interest in it and butternut and the little plant shorty I've had a lot of interest in. And which is a lot of people call Oconee Bells.
But yeah, heard of those. I think there's a song about that. Can't think of it.
I believe there is too,
yeah,
but I can't think. I can't think what.
Yeah. Have you ever heard any Chestnut songs?
Well, Brose would be the folklorist would be the authority on that, I think.
So, do you think the restoration effort will be successful?
I don't know. I've heard claims of success for 40 years, but I'm sure it'd be successful to keep breeding till we get a tree that's similar to American, and that'll be successful, but it won't be American.
Do you see any problem with that, with having this hybrid tree, or?
No, I don't. Mm-hmm. I don't. You know, there are a lot of environmentalists that are opposed to hybridizing anything, but I don't understand that.
It's just, it's a good way to learn. It's free, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's a good practice and all that, but I guess I started learning to play when I was up in Kentucky. And then I picked it up recently. There's some people who learn classical fiddle, mm-hmm, or violin when they're young, and I'm kind of jealous of those people because they just pick it up really quickly, but I just decided to start learning to play like about 3 years ago. So I've been playing for a little while, but definitely got a long way to go. But anyway, it's back on. I deleted some of those old tunes. So one thing I've been asking people too is, so we've been talking about what kind of role the chestnut used to have, you know, being a timber source and feed for livestock and kind of important to the culture. How do you think the chestnut will be used in the 21st century, or whenever it is finally restored? Do you think it'll have to fill those same roles it used to?
No, it won't.
How will it be different?
It'll have the real important use of wildlife food. It'll the wood will be used for all kinds of crafts, not only furniture, but I think I've seen some beautiful pieces that were turned wood, and wood carvers I know use it. And I think there'll be more uses like crafts and things like that. Maybe in furniture. No, not furniture. We've about lost our furniture industry. It may come back, but
maybe it's all just gone.
It's all gone to China.
Mm, yeah. Do you think that people will that the chestnut tree will inspire the same kind of stories and kind of folklore that it did originally?
I don't think so. I think a lot of that went along with the culture. That a lot of those stories are about making apple butter and tapping the trees for maple syrup and all sorts of things like that, where people were self-sufficient, pretty much.
Are there any other, because I guess I'm just curious, since you've worked with all these other kinds of trees before and different kind of restoration stuff, are there as many stories about butternut and different oak trees as there are about chestnut?
No.
Why is that?
I don't know. I think there were so many uses, and it was so outrageously good for things like fattening hogs and building barns and houses and just all sorts of things that they use the lumber for. I mean, when you can cut a 4-foot tree that's straight as pretty as some of those were, and put it on a sawmill and saw whatever size cants out, squares of, and then the cants would go through the ripper saws and rip it into whatever size lumber you want. And it's so easy. And then it'd dry good and everything. Super lumber.
Do you think people would be interested in helping bring the chestnut back?
Sure.
On a large scale?
All kinds of folks would.
What do you think would be some of the main reasons for people to, that would inspire people to get motivated to get involved?
All the stories. Mm. Yeah, and they'll know that, you know, hunters be interested because they'd it'd be such super, I presume, that you can get a lot more animals per acre where there's chestnut in the woods, and although acorns are a fine food too, but not a biologist, but I imagine the carrying capacity per acre would just increase greatly with wildlife.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's true. I'm about done, but do you have any sort of hopes or fears or concerns about the restoration process? Any advice you would have for folks?
No, I just before I put in much planting in, I'd sure want to see the parents of where the seed came from, or know a good bit about them.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether there's any strong relation to what area of the country, how far you can move them without genetic problems.
Yeah.
Some trees you wouldn't want to move over 600 miles or something like that.
Yeah, they're working on that. That's, I guess you probably know this, but they're trying to find all these different mother trees around.
Yeah.
I guess that's part of what you
and elevation about. And
yeah.
And
that's really interesting.
Latitude and longitude.
Mm-hmm. What's the story behind this piece of property that you live on here?
It was inhabited like all of or a big part of Western North Carolina in the 1800s was still a fairly comparatively large Cherokee presence, and this place right here had a grist mill just down the way, and there's a water flume that circles around where this stream goes down. Maybe 3% the flume just goes down 1% or less, and so it builds up away from the stream, and then on down here it would drop down into the grist mill.
Wow.
And so that tells you there's sort of sophisticated farming went on.
Mm-hmm. And chestnuts would have grown here.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I don't see sign of, I don't see any leftovers. They're all gone.
Do you ever hear people, just when you're out getting breakfast at some place or talking to people, does the chestnut come up much at
They
all?
Do.